Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Deceptively Fast podcast. Today we've got Sean Pendergast and Michael Lombardi. Sean and I will discuss a few things, including 80s movies and how they're not all that socially acceptable anymore. And also Michael Lombardi talks about a bunch of stuff in the NFL, including where Bill O'Brien is right now as a head coach and how we might want to think about evaluating him. Michael's on his way back from the West Coast to the East Coast, and we talked to him. He was like 40 miles east of El Paso on his way to the Baylor game. And I'm just always amazed by what that guy has at his fingertips, so to speak. I guess at his brain tips, the memories and the stories he has and just his in-depth knowledge. So awesome stuff from Michael and Sean, as usual. Sean Pendergast back again. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you, Seth?
I'm good. I think last time we talked about how we might be at the dawn of a golden age of Thursday night football. We sit here recording this on a Friday morning. It didn't feel like a golden age type of game between the Patriots and the Colts. And you did see the reemergence for a second straight week of Andrew Luck. And you saw a game that was more competitive in the second half than it looked like it was going to be in the first half. So it wasn't a barn burner, but it was a notable game and a competitive game, if not a classic game, which is way better than we ever expected out of Thursday Night Football in the past.
Well, we talked about it last week from the context of the network partner of the NFL. I know at least that was part of our discussion.
That it's Fox now.
Fox now. And did Fox have discussions about maybe having more say in who the matchups would be or asking for better matchups? And while it wasn't a great game last night, and even on paper coming into the season it wasn't a great game, I think it's a very sellable game.
Right.
When you think of the storylines, right? When you think of just not just the history between the two teams going back to Peyton and Tom Brady, but even within this Andrew Luck era, you've got the Deflategate thing and then Josh McDaniels leaving the Colts at the altar last year. So Colts Patriots, to the average layperson, just the two helmets sitting on the screen and saying, hey, coming up on Thursday night, I think probably if you're just the average NFL fan, knowing that Andrew Luck threw for 460 yards last week, they obviously didn't know that going into the season,
right,
that he was going to throw for 460 yards, but it's still one of those matchups that pops a little bit, especially when you've gotten used to Thursday nights the last few years being kind of meh. But it wasn't a great game, but I think sometimes these matchups you look at it, is this something we can pitch to the audience?
And it's never been the actual game that everybody wants it to be. It's never been the grudge match you want it to be. But I'm glad you brought up the Josh McDaniels thing, because that remains one of the oddest dramatic scenarios I've ever seen in the NFL. And yet, for whatever reason, I almost think people look at it as an afterthought. You had a guy who had accepted a job in his previous employer, and I mean, like, he was going to quit his job with the Patriots to take a job with the Colts. The Patriots, according to Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels at least, didn't even really make much of a pitch for him to stay the first time during the season. They lose the Super Bowl, and then Bill Belichick just Jedi mind tricks Josh McDaniels into sticking around. And this could have been an ultimate showdown between Josh McDaniels and Bill O'Brien. Josh McDaniels going to the enemy. But this is like another instance of how much of it was Bill Belichick desperately needing Josh McDaniels, along with Bill Belichick hating the Colts so much that there's no way in hell he wanted to see him go to the Colts specifically.
Yeah, I would love to know. It would be easier to answer that if we knew exactly what Josh McDaniels got to stay.
Yeah.
You know, did he get a gigantic pay raise? Because when you think about the sacrifice that he made, what NFL team would hire Josh McDaniels now after he did that? Like, even if you thought the guy was a talented head coach, just on principle, I can't hire a guy who told an NFL team yes – left them hanging throughout the entire postseason process, and then said, "Nah, just kidding. I'm going to stay here."
For different reasons, he almost has a Lane Kiffin feel to him now.
Yeah.
Where you can't deny his ability, but you also wonder, like, all right, is there something on this guy's personality that just we can't ultimately do a deal with a guy on a grand scale?
And did he get too much too soon in his career? I think a lot of people argue that with Lane Kiffin, right? He goes and he gets the – He gets the Raiders – his first head coaching job was with the Oakland Raiders. You know, that was his first – at age 32 or something like that. Same way Josh McDaniels is, I think, in his early 30s when the Broncos hired him. So, yeah, and I don't know if Lane Kiffin's going to wind up getting back to where people think he can get back to coaching-wise. I feel like he's in the perfect spot right now, like in CUSA.
He's tweeting about politics.
Yeah.
he just doesn't care.
Being weird, like banging co-eds, living in Boca Raton, winning 9 games. Like I feel like that's the perfect ecosystem for Lane Kiffin. But it's a great analogy. I hadn't thought about that. Like I think the biggest thing is both guys got big keys to big-time – you know, renowned blue blood types. You can say what you want about them. I mean, the Raiders are a traditional organization, or were when Lane Kiffin hired them. They were dysfunctional.
Yeah.
But they had a lot of tradition, as did the Broncos. So, yeah, good analogy with
The one thing about the Patriots, I'd say, is, and this is the frustrating thing every year, is that, okay, they're slow starters. They don't look like the same. It looked like a really, really bad version of it this year. But now they get Julian Edelman back. Brady's looked really sharp for a couple weeks now. Yeah. And it doesn't – there's no reason to believe that the Patriots in the second half of the season, especially by then, aren't going to be as dominant as they ever were.
Well, and the AFC East is kind of showing itself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like everybody was like, hey, look at Sam Darnold after week one, and he's kind of regressed. It's going to be a struggle for the Jets this year. I know the Dolphins started 3-0, but the Patriots put them back in their place.
And Tannehill's doing some nice things, but you still can see that, okay,
we've seen that.
He's not going to elevate people around him.
Yeah, so they're going to have their games in the AFC East, which they're going to win. You know, I think the biggest thing in the AFC is that the Steelers look – you know, the Steelers are dysfunctional and messy right now, and they were supposed to be the clear number two team. So there's no – and even with Kansas City 4-0 right now, I thought that was a nice win in Denver the way they had to win it. But that defense is really, really bad. It's a terrible defense. So, yeah, the Patriots, and I haven't looked at the odds, but I got to guess the Patriots are probably still the favorite to win the AFC.
And the thing about their defense is they've always got certain deficiencies on defense, and then they get better as the season goes along. I think that, more than anything, is the best indicator of how good a coach Belichick is, because it's always easy to have that debate about, okay, how much did Belichick make Brady and vice versa. Their defense gets better as the season goes along consistently simply because they're better coached. They make do with usually not having great pass rushers, and over the course of a season, I watch it. I've seen it. Like, I've seen the Patriots defense last year when they played the Texans early on. Their defensive linemen were playing with poor technique, mm-hmm. weren't maintaining their leverage. Then you get towards the end of the season, and you see they're still not a great defense, but they're just more technically sound.
Yeah.
And guys on the back end, they're still not technically great. They're not athletically awesome, but they're disciplined.
Yeah, and that leads directly to what they're really good at, which is situational football. They're just so good at getting off of the field on third down. They're really good in the red zone. They've always been that way.
Yeah.
They've always been that way. By the way, Patriots and Chiefs, both about 3-1 to win the AFC right now. So the Chiefs are a small favorite over the Patriots to win the AFC.
When we get to your picks, I don't think you did the Chiefs, but I am really interested to see how the Chiefs
talk about that.
How he does this week versus that defense.
Yeah.
A couple things came up during our show today that were off air, like during the break, which there were topics that I wish we had talked about on air.
That happens on our show.
And too. I thought that you would I wanted to talk to you about this. Kylie Wong and I started talking about Kill the Carrier, the old childhood game. And we started talking about it because I was telling
called by a much less politically correct name.
Well, I was at a soccer game last year, and these kids, like these little fourth and fifth graders, were behind me, and I overheard one of them say, "Hey, let's play Smear the Queer."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Whoa."
Yeah, dude.
Wait a minute. What the hell? And I turned around, and I had one of those moments where I was like, do I talk to these strangers' kids about, hey, like, let me talk to you about Stonewall and the significance of, but anyway, Kill the Carrier.
Yeah.
And we just, that was our standard name for it, was Kill the Carrier.
Yeah.
Paul Gallant said they had a name for it. It was like Kill the Man with the Ball.
We called it that, too.
You called it Kill the Man with the Ball? What the hell is that?
We called it Smear the Queer and Kill the Man with the Ball.
That's a weird one, Kill the Man with the Ball. There's no ring to that.
It might be a New England thing. Because Paul was – I know Paul spent high school in Florida, but I think he spent his formative Smear the Queer years in New England.
So just an awful name, obviously. But in terms of the game itself – we're trying to figure out, like, is there another game like that where there is no object to that game? Like, there's no – you don't score a goal. You don't get points or anything. You just toss the ball up to somebody. They catch it. And then they try to run. They can throw it away any chance they want, right? You can throw it away.
Yeah, yeah.
But you just keep going.
Yeah.
No, or is it – do you have to get tackled before you give the ball up?
You have to boy, that's a good question.
I guess the rules might vary.
The exact rules. But you on paper, you definitely should not want the ball.
Yeah.
But there was a certain, like, rush to having the ball in that game. And, like, plowing guys over and making guys miss. And, yeah, the goal with us was just to be able to make it back in from recess.
Right.
You know?
Like, that just was, to, like, you mean
like
we don't
not
have
go to,
the
nurse's office.
Listen, kids, if you're listening to this, younger people, for one, don't use the previous name for that game. Right. Two, look – video games used to really suck. Okay, yeah. Like there was the Game Boy wasn't even invented until like the mid 90s. It was not a great time to be doing anything other than just trying to crush each other outside.
It's so funny you say that, Seth, because when you and I were talking about this right before we started recording, I was thinking, God, what other games did we play when I was a kid that just had no tangible scoreboard at the end of the game? And we used to play a real life game like Call of Duty, but the real life version. Like we had like our fake guns,
right,
and our camo. We lived in a pretty rural part of the, you know, a pretty rural neighborhood.
We did it with BB guns.
Okay, we didn't actually have ammunition.
Yeah,
that's hardcore.
Yeah,
no, dumb. We would just like we would send like two teams like out into the woods, and you when you see a guy, you scream. I forget what we called it. We called it PAGA. PAGA Peter! PAGA! I don't know why it was like, maybe it was a form
some
of
some version
peg,
of tag or
of PAG.
PAG
or
yeah.
Tag or maybe a combination of those two. We called the game PAGA. And it was PAGA Peter. And then once you.
If you had a clear line of sight to him and you saw him before he saw
yelled,
you, then it was.
Yeah, and you yelled and they would have to concede and you get to bring them over to the prison.
That was just simply body counts there. There at least you're keeping count. That's why Vietnam failed, by the way. It was when they. Well, aside from all the other reasons.
Because our guys just yelled PAGA.
Well, when they lost the. According to at least the Ken Burns documentary. It was just obviously a whole quagmire, but they started measuring their objectives just in kill counts, which was really, really bad because for one reason, morale on the ground was like, okay, we'd take a hill and then the next day give it back.
Yeah.
So you'd lose all these casualties and then they start realizing like all we're trying to do is have a higher body count.
Yeah.
But then back home, you might see, okay, well, hey, this week or this month, we killed however many of the enemy. People don't see that number as much as like, oh wow, and 100 Americans died.
Right.
You know,
right.
And you're not gaining ground or anything. You're just counting bodies.
Yeah.
So good for you guys. You guys were a product
The Vietnam era.
Yeah, and also just the lack of morale in the country that came from after Vietnam. Because you didn't grow up. It's not like you were you could have been drafted in the NAM.
No. And it was the early 80s. There was a lot of coke. You know, it was
a lot of coke floating around your middle school.
Be gone,
sir.
I got to burn all this energy somehow. Where's my fake gun?
So what we settled on was that it was like the most pure form of us as social animals going out and playing is a form of just like a combative play, which whatever gets you ready for later in life. But also the real goal of that game is to prove your worth. Like it's to prove your bravery or your virility or whatever it is. It's like that's all it is. Like how gallant can you be while people are trying to kill you?
And it fills that thrill-seeking void that some people
have. Like, yeah, there's something about just wanting to go out and maybe – face getting the snot beat out of you with the football in your hands.
Exactly, exactly.
The other one I had, in light of all the Brett Kavanaugh stuff,
there's a lot of voting going on my TV this morning.
Really? It's been a fun 2 years. Kavanaugh, now, I got into a discussion with one of my friends, and we were talking about high school, and then we started, like, telling stories. Nothing that's going to, you know, come up in a congressional hearing in it. But for the first time in my life over these last couple of years, I start having this feeling when I'm thinking about my high school stories and some of the stuff like that I might have done with girlfriends or whatever, I get really freaked out thinking about how young we both were. And it's I feel weird even going back to that spot in my memory.
Yeah.
Because those are like, that's young, man. It's young and it's messed up. And I don't even like thinking about it now where I have like this emotional wall.
I didn't know the whole story. I'm going to try to talk about this without getting too into the weeds. I didn't know the whole story about Kavanaugh until obviously a lot of this stuff came to light once he got nominated for this spot by the president. And when I first heard it, I'm thinking, okay, this must be stuff that's pretty recent. Wow, this is, do we have like a Clarence Thomas situation on our hands or whatever? And then I see the stories about him. I'm like, this is all stuff from back when he was in college. And I'm not condoning any of the stuff he did. But I'm like you. I started going through my head. I'm like, God, I went to a lot of dances back in the day.
Right.
How could some of the things that I did be construed a certain way?
But even among.
Like, I wasn't a pig or anything.
No, you're not a pig or anything. Or like even between two consenting adolescents.
Right.
That's the problem is like I'm thinking in my mind and I'm shocked and dismayed. As a parent now, I'm shocked and dismayed about the stuff that we did as like consenting adolescents between each other, and I'm very uncomfortable with all of it, including my own mind, because in my own mind, I'm a 43-year-old looking in my mind's eye at these teenagers, and that feels creepy in and of itself, though I'm the teenager.
You know what else it made me think of is the movies back in the 80s.
Yeah.
You ever go back and watch Revenge of the Nerds and count how many felonies were committed in that movie? And it was a movie at the end of the day where like, oh, this is just some college hijinks, just putting spy cams in a girl's sorority and Lewis basically posing as Betty Child's boyfriend and kind of quasi-date raping her in the moon bouncy thing.
Well, Molly Ringwald wrote a big piece and it was really interesting. And it's one of those things I think a lot of people might have in the knee jerk like, oh, whatever, you're feeling. You're making too much of this. You go back and you look at some of the scenes in like 16 Candles and some of those other coming of age movies.
Yeah.
And there is like a kind of just a real loose attitude about like, oh, she was passed out and drugged up, and all this stuff. That's like, it's really shocking.
Hey, and not only did that stuff happen, but like, they fell in love. Like, she fell in love with the geek who date raped her in the back of the Jake's Rolls.
That's
it.
But that's not ever like now in that, in defense of that scene, if I'm remembering it right, so when Anthony Michael Hall and the hot teenage homecoming queen are in the back seat, neither one of them really remember anything. They were both in an extreme state.
I don't think
some people have pointed that as to like, oh, he must have taken advantage of her while she was passed out.
Like,
I think there's a lot of haziness there.
There was. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right about that.
But there are other
doesn't
scenes
make it
where
right.
they kind of yeah. So football. Perfect segue into football. Bunch of cretins.
Can we do a podcast on Revenge of the Nerds someday?
Because Revenge of the Nerds.
That's what I'm saying. If you count up the felonies in Revenge of the Nerds, I'm going to go watch Revenge of the Nerds and count up the felonies.
Well, the whole, and then the whole concept of like a panty raid, which I think that had fallen by the wayside. But what was that like back in the 50s, 60s, 70s where – on college campuses,
I feel like it's something my parents talked
about. That's a really creepy thing.
Yeah. Like, they had one in Revenge of the Nerds. They did a panty
they
raid.
Did a panty
they
raid.
Did a panty raid. Yeah, they panty raided the sorority was.
Unlike Kill the Carrier, at least there's an objective in that game.
There is, yeah, whoever scores the most panties.
Your
football.
College picks.
Yeah.
So let's see.
You're crushing it lately.
You're crushing it. What's your record now?
8-2 in my last 10 against the spread in college.
Now, do you keep track? Do you keep track on the dollars and cents side? Like, because if you're actively gambling.
Yeah.
There's some picks that you just simply feel stronger about.
Well, these are best bets, so I would bet what my normal max is on all of them. So people can do their own math.
You don't ever increase your total because you feel really strongly about for the most part.
I feel the ones I give out on this podcast or give out on the Houston Press are the ones I feel best about.
Yeah.
They're not the only games that I bet.
Yeah.
There are other games I bet, but at a lower level.
Okay.
Yeah, so
I gotcha.
Yeah, so these are ones I'll bet. My big bet's probably, just to give people an idea, my big bet's probably $100 on a game.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a $1,000 a game guy or anything like that. $100.
And you're good enough at it that you're not like if you put a limit on how much you bet, you're not going to get in a tremendous amount of trouble unless you start using emotion too much, right? And start like do a lot of people get in trouble where they like they go against their better instincts and like they'll go because they have a feeling about something and then they'll they'll just have a it's hard to lose extremely against the spread without being really boneheaded, right?
Yeah, you know where people were, and we're in the past, I've gotten into the weeds a little bit with betting, is when you're watching games during the day and you overanalyze things and you hear some little bit of news about a game, you go, "Oh, I didn't bet anything on that game. That's a little bit of news I didn't know. Maybe I'll throw something down on this." And this is why the legalization of it in these states is going to be a big boon in a lot of these places, the live wagering. You know, you see a game that's at halftime and a team that's a big favorite is way down. So you feel like, well, they're going to come back in the second half. They're just a better team. Identifying things that you think are opportunities to bet in game or at halftime, that's where you can start to kind of – it can start to spiral a little bit, you know.
I used to when I used to do daily fantasy.
Because real quick, hold that thought. Because real quick, what happens is that was money you weren't planning on losing going into the weekend or the beginning of the day, and the same mentality that gets you betting on those things, or the same mentality that gets you chasing to try to make up for what you may have just lost.
Right.
Daily fantasy.
Yeah. Forget my last thought. It was a dumb one.
Okay.
Baylor, you're taking Baylor -4.5 over Kansas State.
I am. I'm actually going to be at that game this weekend, and that is not why I'm betting on it. But I think this Baylor team, they got beat up pretty good last week by Oklahoma, but Oklahoma will do that to teams that are just two levels lower than them. I think this Baylor defense is vastly improved. This is mostly a bet against Kansas State as much as it is a bet on Baylor.
It's a bet against Bill Snyder. Bold move. You hate Bill Snyder.
Old people in general.
Honestly, my uninformed take about this would be like, I saw way too many fawning pieces about Bill Snyder this week. I almost feel like amongst the betting public, K-State's got a little bit more shine than they should because people love Bill Snyder.
Yeah, and this is K-State's been a team historically that's able to kind of rise up and win a few games here and there during the, you know, we know what they've been under Bill Snyder. This is a bad K-State. This is the problem with this K-State team is they can't score.
Yeah.
They're bad offensively. Baylor's a pretty good offensive team. They've got some weapons. The defense is a little bit improved this year. It's much improved this year over last year, even though they gave up 66 to Oklahoma last week. Oklahoma's just really, really good. Kansas State's coming off a kind of a tough nip-and-tuck loss against Texas, which I think is a game they get up for every year. So I don't think very highly of Kansas State. I think there's a little bit of a letdown for them traveling to Waco. So I think Baylor wins this game by at least a touchdown.
And then you've got Vanderbilt +27 over Georgia.
Yeah. So I know people are probably like, you're betting on Vanderbilt. You're getting 27 points, 27.5. And if it's 27.5 and you can buy it up to 28, then that's a football number. But whatever the case.
I've used football number. I've learned that from you.
Yeah.
I actually was talking to somebody today about a football number.
3, 7, 10. Yeah, that's good stuff. Vanderbilt is, I know that they're, you know, I know where they stack up in the SEC. I watched them play against Notre Dame earlier this year at Notre Dame. Their quarterback is Kyle Shermer, who I think is either the nephew or the son of Pat Shermer, the coach of the Giants. He's a pretty good quarterback. He can move the football a little bit. Georgia's really, really good, obviously, but they've got a stretch of schedule coming up where they play 4 ranked teams in the SEC the next 4 games. They play LSU next week in Baton Rouge. I just think – and then they follow that up. They've got Florida and Jacksonville for the cocktail party. And they've got Kentucky after that, and they've got one more ranked team after that, either Auburn or Alabama.
Yeah.
I think it's Auburn. They play Auburn after that. So those are 4 really good teams stacked up in a row. I think this is a big look-ahead spot for Georgia where they're not going to show a lot of stuff because of what they have coming up on the schedule. I think if Vanderbilt can get a couple touchdowns, they can hang within 27.
And then I'll just read this off. Stanford -5 over Utah, and then anything quick on that?
Stanford is coming off of 2 tough road trips, 1 to Oregon, 1 to Notre Dame. I think being back at home is going to be kind of a boost to them, and I think Utah's not a very good offensive team. So I think Stanford is going to feel the relief of being back home. And losing to Notre Dame, that's our first loss of the year, but it's still out of conference. So they still got everything in front of them to play for in the Pac-12.
Ravens -3 over Browns. I'll be honest, I'm shocked by this spread. For the life of me, I don't know what the Browns have done to deserve this kind of respect versus that Ravens defense, which – Sean, do you realize they haven't allowed a touchdown in the second half yet?
I think they're the best team in the AFC right now.
They're giving up 2.2 points per second half. They are the old Ravens defense, and they're getting there. And Joe, I heard Boomer Esiason on a Sports Minute yesterday talk about how some of the games that you shouldn't get all excited about include the Ravens because Joe Flacco is Joe Flacco. Like, no, no, no.
Not this year.
Joe Flacco is not Joe Flacco. He's been different. This is a much better offense.
He's been good. They've been great in the red zone this year.
Yeah.
That's been a big thing for them. Yeah, there's a theory, Steph, there's a theory going on in Vegas right now. I listened to a couple of Vegas podcasts, and there's a theory going on in Vegas, and it's gone on for a while now. Even while the Browns were losing games last year, we remember, until it got bad at the end of the year, they were losing a lot of close
games. They were close. They were blowing leads in the fourth quarter, even.
They were finding ways to lose games.
Yeah.
So there's a theory, but they were still, in a lot of those games, not covering the spread. They were hanging in games, but they still had a bad record against the spread last year. But the Sharps in Vegas were betting, like, of all the teams that they were losing on last year, the Sharps, they were losing a lot on the Browns because the Sharps were betting on the Browns, you know, thinking they were getting value. And as a result, the Browns have become one of the more popular teams to bet on in Vegas with the Sharps. The theory in Vegas is that the Sharps are trying to look so smart by betting on the Browns.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That they're like, the Browns have such a bad reputation that the betting public doesn't actually know what they're watching.
Yeah, and the Sharps are the ones who kind of know. Like, the Sharps are – it's almost like the people who are on Twitter who, when you try to make an observation about, like, the Astros – they think they're like, you're like, oh, you don't know.
You don't know. You don't know baseball, right?
Right.
And actually, no, the bullpen is just fine. And then after Luno makes a bunch of moves, like, well, Luno had to improve the bullpen. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the Sharps are in, you know, the Sharps have been betting heavily on the Browns. Well, the casinos adjust to that. And the result has been that the Browns at the end, you know, by the time game time rolls around, the Browns spreads are even smaller than they should be.
Right.
Like the Sharps, there's probably a lot of Sharps on the Browns this week, so the sports books are setting it at 3, when in actuality it probably should be closer to 4 or 4.5.
I like this pick a lot because I like Baker Mayfield a lot. But I actually heard people saying, like, well, the Browns receivers just have to adjust to a different velocity on Baker Mayfield, and that's why they're dropping it. No! They're dropping the ball because they're not good receivers.
Yeah.
Like, they do some good things. But that's versus a Raiders defense that is not a good defense. And also, Joe Flacco versus that Browns defense, that Greg Williams defense, there are opportunities. Because Greg Williams does not have fundamentally sound defenses.
Yeah.
He kind of brings people from all over the place, but they can be torched. And I think this is the Ravens team that can do it.
John Harbaugh always has good special teams as well. And I think the other thing is Jimmy Smith is back. Jimmy Smith is done serving his 4-game suspension. Jimmy Smith has a similar effect on the Ravens, like we've seen. Sean Lee's a good example in Dallas. Like,
yeah,
when Sean Lee's on the field, the Cowboys are the equivalent of like a top 6 defense in terms of yards per play, which in the gambling world, that's the big stat, is offensively and defensively is yards per play. With Sean Lee off of the field, they give up like over six yards per play, which is one of the worst defenses in the league. I don't know the exact numbers for Jimmy Smith, but it's a similar effect, and he's back from his suspension.
In terms of football numbers in the score, this is an interesting one to me now with the Browns, because I didn't realize this, and it wasn't written about that I saw, at least, but I was rewatching the game a little. I was actually watching the game the other day. The Browns went for two, like 4 times in a row, at least.
Did they really?
Yeah, I didn't see a whole lot of it written about that, but like from their first score, they started going for two all the time.
Really?
I'll go back and double check that. Maybe I was really drunk by the time I was watching that.
That feels very Chip Kelly like.
Yeah.
Chip Kelly does that.
Yeah.
They score first, and I think I'll go for two to make the score a little weird at the beginning of the game.
I trust Chip Kelly if he has that strategy.
Hugh Jackson, not so much.
Seahawks +7.5 over the Rams. Yeah. I'm skeptical. But intrigued. This is in Seattle,
it's in
and that
Seattle.
Makes a difference.
It's a value play on Seattle as a home team, and I think a home team that's maybe a little underestimated because they started 0-2.
Mm-hmm.
They started 0-2. They lost in Denver week one. I think we've seen that Denver is not a terrible team. They're a decent team. And they lost to the Bears in week two. It turns out the Bears are a pretty frisky team as well. Those are both losses on the road that they had to start the season. And in retrospect, at least in this little early segment of the season, they weren't bad losses. Seahawks, they beat the Cowboys badly in week three. They kind of escaped from Arizona last week with a win. So they're 2-2. I don't think they're a bad 2-2. Look, if you're going to back a home dog by more than a touchdown, I want to make sure their quarterback is one of the better quarterbacks in the league, which Russell Wilson is, even though that offensive line isn't very good. That's a scary matchup in this game. But this is a play, and that half a point is big. Again, back to the football number. The football number of 7, the difference between 7 and 7.5 is absolutely gigantic. So it's purely a play, Seth, on the Seahawks being in a position where we rarely see them as a home dog, let alone a home dog this big. The last time they were a home dog this big was the Beastquake playoff game against New Orleans back in 2010.
And I'm also interested in seeing over the course of the season how some of that Rams offense plays out with crowd noise. Some of the cool backfield action stuff they do and with jet sweeps and whatnot, some of that requires really good timing. And when you lose the snap count, you lose some of that. And that Seahawks, I don't want to say intimidating. You never really get intimidated by the environment. But, like, as a player, that was by far one of the coolest places I ever played. Like, it feels like, I don't know what the decibel level is, but the way it affects you on the field is that it feels like there's a complete wall of noise enveloping
you. Would you have loved to have played there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is a great crowd there.
Yeah, this is, by the way, first trip even out of the state of California for the Rams this season.
Oh,
so
wow.
Not only to a rough road environment. I feel
it's a long trip. I think sometimes people think in their minds, like, oh, West Coast is West Coast. Like, that's a haul.
And and you don't feel like you're on the West Coast when you're in Seattle either. You feel like you're, like, this time of year, you feel like you're probably in Omaha.
You feel like you're in some weird dystopian, like, post-nuclear war environment. Like, the light is just kind of different. It's just, everything's kind of eerie.
Yep.
The Falcons Steelers, you're taking the over. I cannot fault you for that. Neither of these teams seem to care about defense anymore.
At all.
It's been really sad to watch. It's one thing from the Falcons. Like, okay, the Falcons have never had a reputation as tough or brawlers or anything like that, even when they're good on defense. The Steelers in this just complete ineptitude
and
abdication of responsibility at times. It's freaking me out.
As George Costanza described his scalp one time, that is a place where a once great society of hair once stood. That's the Steelers defense. This is where a once great society of defense once stood. The last 3 weeks for the Falcons, Seth, the final scores, 31-24, 43-37, and 37-36.
Both these teams, I feel, should have better pass rushes than they do, but I'm starting to wonder in today's NFL, I even wonder when the pass rush is good, how much it bails you out. Because you look at
the
Falcons actually had a bunch of hits on Drew Brees or a bunch of pressure on Drew Brees a couple weeks ago, and it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Yeah, the Texans last week, Clowney and J.J. Watt were playing out of their minds. It's just there's so many opportunities all over the field for good quarterbacks to do something.
There are, and guys are getting – teams are getting smarter about game planning against it, too, with the way they get the ball out so fast. So, yeah, it's these two teams actually do have talented players in their front sevens. You know, the Falcons have I can't remember if Beasley is injured or not or if he's been playing, but Grady Jarrett and Vic Beasley and the Steelers have T.J. Watt and Bud Dupree and some good guys on that defensive line. It hasn't mattered. Hasn't mattered.
All right, man. Good stuff. I got to go. I got to go dig up my old high school calendars, get my alibis in.
That sounds like a hell of an afternoon.
That's what we're doing. I'm going to Kavanaugh it up. So, all right, buddy. Take it easy.
Appreciate it.
Enjoy the baseball games.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Now, up next, we've got Michael Lombardi. He joins us every week on Mad Radio on Thursday mornings at 9:20 a.m., and he always brings it. But the two voices, for those of you that aren't here in Houston that you hear on there, are my co-host, Mike Meltzer. You can follow him on Twitter at Mike Meltzer, Meltzer with an S, and at Gallant Says, G-A-L-L-A-N-T. SAYS. They are both awesome professionals and they do a great job with me. So here's Michael Lombardi. And joining us now is Michael Lombardi, author of Gridiron Genius, a master's class in winning championships and building dynasties in the NFL. He writes for The Ringer and The Athletic as well. Longtime NFL personnel man. Michael, good morning. And I'm guessing that given the current state of the Houston Texans, we might be the only people this week that ask you about the emergence of Kiki QT, who breaks a record for number of catches in an NFL debut, and yet I don't know if I've seen his name once anywhere in a national publication. Am I allowed to get excited about Kiki QT?
I don't see why not. I mean, the kid played really well last week. I mean, it took Bruce Ellington's injury for him to get on the field, and he responded. And so, look, I think he's done well. I think the key for the Texans offense and for him specifically is Will Fuller. I mean, when Will Fuller's on the field, the Texans are a different team. You know, it helps Hopkins. It takes a lot of the pressure off him, and it takes it off of Coty. So I think you should be as excited about him as everyone. Of course, naturally, the national narrative won't ever get to it. They're too busy talking about the Philly special.
Yes. Mike, it seemed to my eye like O'Brien did clearly change the offense on Sunday, and it seemed like QT was kind of the focal point before the snap. Why is he claiming like he didn't change the offense?
Well, I mean, look, it's game plan specific is what Bill does. And so he's playing against a team like the Indianapolis Colts. It's a lot of zone. they needed an inside slot receiver, and especially with Watson's movement in the pocket, which creates alleys, it's always hard for the Tampa 2 scheme, the Monty Kiffin schemes, to handle quarterbacks with movement because they're a zone team and everything's in space. And what do they teach you in basketball about space? Pass the ball quickly from one side to the other and you create open shots. It's the same thing in football. You need spacing inside, and that's why Coté was so effective.
The Texans are going up against and running back in Ezekiel Elliott, who can do a lot of different things to them, whether it's running the football or catching the football out of the backfield, as he showed against the Detroit Lions last week. What's it going to take for the Texans to stop him? Obviously, they've got Jadeveon Clowney and J.J. Watt in the front seven, but just a couple of weeks ago, Saquon Barkley really carved him up.
Yeah, I think it's a key game for the Texans. I mean, they've got to win first down. They've got to be able to get where they can put the pressure on the Cowboys' passing game to be a little more diversified off of not being in second and short, third and short, stuff like that. Elliott really hasn't been a factor in the passing game. I mean, I thought it was coaching malpractice up until last week, until they finally used him. They actually called a screen last week, and they actually got him out in space and threw a route into him. I mean, he was averaging under 4 yards a catch going into the Lions game, and he emerged. I mean, he's the weapon of their team. And to me, it's the Romeo Crennel. You're going into the game plan saying, look, we got to stop Elliott. No matter where he is on the field, we got to stop him. When he extends out, here's what they do with him, and then go from there and build the game plan that way. But I think if you're a Texan fan, you got to be encouraged by the way Clowney played last week. He actually looked like the Clowney that I remember, and I thought that was good. I think they've got to rotate J.J. Watt more. I mean, J.J. Watt was absolutely dynamic in the first half, but he wore down in the second half. Too many reps. I think less of J.J. means more of J.J.
That's a. I brought up that point earlier in the week, and how do you do that with a guy like J.J. who wants to be out there every snap? And, look, he's going to do what you tell him to do. As a coach, you have to figure out, all right, we've got to balance this and have this fourth quarter mentality. Is it a matter of having that Belichick mentality of, look, the first three games are all just a prelude to the real game, which is the fourth quarter, so you're going to be a little bit weaker on defense at times in the first three quarters, but those just don't matter. We need J.J. in that fourth quarter.
Yeah, I would put in his locker when he's not there pictures of Michael Jordan sitting on the bench during a game and just let him know that, look, even great players need a rest. You know, and look, we need you out there, but Michael Jordan didn't play 48 minutes every night. You know, Michael Jordan needed to be fresh for the fourth quarter. We need you for the fourth quarter because we're going to be in these close games and we got to get you to create the plays in the fourth quarter. And when he sees it visually like that, it becomes it's easier to talk to him about it. When you're taking him off the field during the game without a conversation, he's like, man, I'm fresh. I feel good. Well, no, we're saving you. And I think you got to have a talk about it.
Mike, I know it's 4 days later. Did you like or dislike Frank Reich on the 4th-and-4 going for it?
I didn't like it at all because, look, I get the understanding nobody plays for a tie, but you don't know what's going to happen if you get the ball back. I mean, we've seen the Texans shoot themselves in the foot too many times this year to think that they've got this thing nailed down, right? So it could be a blocked punt. I mean, anything. I mean, I think a job of a head coach is to make sure you put your team in the best position to win. Now, if he converts on fourth down, look, he's got the number one third down passing game in football, Frank Reich. So I understand why he did it because they've been very effective on third down. But I didn't like it because I think it comes down to one play, and I hate throwing hitches just like I hate throwing fades in the end zone. I think it's lazy coaching. I think it just, to me, it's not really designing a best way to get the play. If he would have probably run something else, maybe I would have liked it more. But to me, to run a hitch, you know, and to do it that way, I wasn't excited about it. Plus, I think it doesn't give your team a chance to win.
Mike, you've called Jason Garrett the Clapper, and this name doesn't quite roll off the tongue as well, but after watching him on the All or Nothing last season with the Dallas Cowboys, I feel like he's the unnecessary swearer. He swears a lot for no reason, and it's weird because he's so understated with his actual motivational speeches that he gives. We've been playing audio of that all day, but him as a head coach, what's his biggest issue, and honestly, how has he kept his job so long?
Well, I think he fits Jerry Jones's profile, what he wants for a head coach. I mean, Jerry wants somebody who's good. I think that's the answer to it. I call him the Clapper because all I have watched him do is clap. He's got this reputation for being an offensive guru, but I haven't seen much of the roux in the guru, you know. And so now the play calling's in Scott Linehan's hands. you know, Rod Marinelli runs the defense, and you know, what actually happens? I mean, what's going on? I mean, I just don't know, and that's what, to me, if you're going to stand on the sideline, you got to be involved in the game completely. And if your reputation is that of an offensive guru, and the offense looks as stagnant at times as the Cowboys does, you got to question it.
Speaking with Michael Lombardi, author of Gridiron Genius, Michael, one of the most fascinating parts of your book to me is where you break down what makes a good head coach, or at least what does the head coach need? And to you, it boils mostly down to leadership, and you can do it in different ways. You could be like Marv Levy. You could be like Bill Belichick. That's the thing about Bill O'Brien that I actually think he very much has in his favor. I feel like he's a natural leader of football players. What's been holding him back from maybe being better than he has been these last 4 years?
I think really I don't think he's gotten the staff, and I think where Bill misses, I think it's about training the staff. I think Bill's got all the things he needs. I think maybe now with Brian Gain, he's got somebody he trusts in the front office, and that certainly could help him. But I think it's all part of the staff. You know, he's got Romeo there, and he's got to develop young staff members, I think, that fit into the philosophy. That was the hard thing in Cleveland when we first started out, you know, was to develop those young coaches. Eventually we did, and if you watch the Cleveland 95 documentary, there was a lot of good coaches that started Cleveland. I think that's the challenge. And then the details. I mean, look, the longer you're a head coach, the details become more obvious to you. And I think that's what Bill's got to keep working at. Look, I admire him. He benched Davenport last night. I mean, at some point I was going to ask the question, how many more false starts before a guy gets benched?
Yeah.
And when you do that, you send a message to your team saying, look, I don't tolerate it. Remember this about coaching.
I think our line maybe. Did we drop him completely, or is might have to reestablish him?
Let's reach him out, in and out, in and out.
The one thing too, and I'm to very excited.
I'm like listening basically closely to what he was about to say about Davenport.
Well, one of the points he makes in his book is, and this is where I'll give credit to both Rick Smith and Bill O'Brien, was a coach's willingness to bench a high-priced free agent or a high draft pick goes a long way in the locker room. It goes a long, long way in the locker room. Do we have him back up, Jonesy?
No, not yet. No. He's reconnecting.
So, and O'Brien's showing through the years that he's willing to do that. And it is. There's something there. Like, when you look at Jason Garrett versus Bill O'Brien, you can just tell. You can feel it. Like, you don't know how to define it, but O'Brien has a certain leadership ability that I think some other coaches don't do.
I agree.
And it's a matter of filling in everything around him. One of the points that Lombardi makes in his book about when he was first working with Bill Belichick in Cleveland was how important Belichick treats special teams. And that they always felt that if you take a good special teams player, you can teach him over the course of a few years how to be a good football player, and that's where you can get really good value in the draft. One of the most encouraging things about the Texans so far this year for their long run is the fact that they're third in DVOA in special teams.
Yes.
After having been at the bottom of the barrel for years and years and years, they're one of the best teams in the league this year in special teams, because I think partly because that one fake punt doesn't count against their special team stats. But that's a good sign for Brian Gain for me. They've actually addressed these concerns, and that some of these good special teams players should develop into good bargains as NFL players.
Well, that's why there are some weird things going on with the Texans, where Vegas thinks highly of them, the advanced stats think highly of them. You know, special teams have gotten way better. The rookie class has been very good, especially a rookie class without a first or second round pick. So you have all these different things going on that should be good, and yet you feel kind of like, all right, can I really buy into this team at 1-3, given how bad the start was? So it's a bunch of weird things going on. But Seth is 100% right. The special teams has been way better, and I looked it up last night that the best part of their special teams so far has actually been the punting. So the decision to go with Daniel over Leckler has worked out. I think we have reconnected with Michael Lombardi. And Michael, we had a shaky connection, but you were just talking about Bill O'Brien and the decision to bench Julian Davenport before you cut out. And I think we dropped. It's like
that's
I'm cursed.
Right.
The line is cursed.
We had a good 10 minutes with him.
We did have a good 10 minutes. That's true. I thought the thing I wrote down that was probably the most interesting thing as it relates to this game and then moving forward is they got to rotate Watt more. And I know, as Seth, you mentioned the follow-up question, that it's tough to do because he's not going to necessarily want to do that. But you do have some options there.
Yeah.
You have Merciless. You've got Ejiofor. They're obviously not as good, but that's something that you can do.
And I think they need to do. Because it's like J.J. Watt's reps and Jadeveon Clowney's reps aren't normal reps either, because they're getting double teamed so much that it just, you have to grind out that much more and use that much more juice to get it done. So I think you'll see that. And that Belichick philosophy, and I can't even remember how the fractions work out, basically he treats the first three quarters like the first, they're only worth 50%. I don't know. It's all about setting up for the fourth quarter.
Okay.
That, and if you look at the Super Bowl, it's kind of that way. That by the time you get to the fourth quarter, okay, you figured out exactly what you need to do, and you're in good, and you're in shape enough, and you're fresh enough to do it. The other thing I wanted to ask him was, I need to see a downside of Pat Mahomes. I need somebody to tell me where Pat Mahomes might not make it as like a really good quarterback. And I guess the only thing would be is, right now you're seeing him surrounded by a bunch of awesome talent and incredible speed on the field. Like, I guess he hasn't really had to, you know, if Josh Rosen were in the same situation and he were in his second year, would Josh Rosen look anything like this? And it's hard because he makes incredible throws.
I guess
it's not like he's just a product of the system.
I guess if you're an opposing defensive coordinator, I'm looking at Kansas City and I feel like, all right, if I can just shut down the run and not allow deep passes to Tyreek Hill, then maybe I have a fighting chance. That's how I'm looking at it.
Yeah, and I mean, even then, I just don't know that you can take away. Like, they need an injury or something like that, I feel, that will get them off track for a little bit, and then you'll have to see Patrick Mahomes struggle. But, I mean, you've got a guy for every single level of the field. You got Travis Kelce over the middle. You have Tyreek Hill downfield. You have Sammy Watkins 10 yards down the field. Out of the backfield, and you've got Kareem Hunt. I mean, he has too many weapons to fail, I think.
Yeah.
At this point, he might. Pat Mahomes, by the way, the AFC Offensive Player of the Month. J.J. Watt was the AFC Defensive Player of the Month. Khalil Mack was the NFC Defensive Player of the Month. So those are your awards.
I really love the latter.
So who is the NFC Offensive Player of the Month?
I don't care.
I'm going to guess Jared Goff.
I think that's probably a good guess.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.